second hour of We the People Radio. I'm Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
And Jared doesn't know that we have him say his name, so he's Jared.
Yeah, I'm Jared.
Yeah. He's not Bob.
I'd give you Jared's last name, but I don't know it. It's a secret. He's Jared sitting in Bob's chair. Bob's at a baseball game? I think Bob's at a baseball game.
I'm not sure. He didn't actually tell me why he was.
Yeah, I think he said it was a baseball game.
Yeah.
Are there baseball games playing somewhere far away?
I wouldn't be the guy to ask.
Yeah, I know. Me either, obviously.
I'm a big fan.
We're obviously all professional sports fanatics.
Absolutely.
So let's see. The first hour today, we played you an archive from May. I hope you liked it. I thought it was a lot of good, interesting information that you don't hear in the mainstream media from a guy that can definitely tackle the subject and, I don't know, call him an expert. How's that? So, second hour today, we're talking about the excessive class action attorneys' fees. What do you call them, class action things where, you know, you send in your postcard and then you get 12 cents back,
yeah,
like 10 years later.
In fact, I think we got 30 cents here not too long ago. In the mail. We won. We were happy.
Yeah, you win. You get 30 cents.
Hey, you've been successful.
So, our guest today, Lawrence Schombrun, we've had him on before. I believe it was in April. I'll have to look. For whatever reason, I did not attach that show, but I will for you. And he is a nationally recognized authority on the issue of reasonableness of attorney's fees awards in class actions. He's appeared on behalf of unnamed class. Whoops! Don't touch the screen while you're reading it. I just committed the touch screen error. You touch it, it gets really big. Then you can only see one word at a time. Not good. He's appeared on behalf of unnamed class members in approximately 200 class actions throughout the United States. A New York native, now living in Northern California, he received his undergraduate degree from the University of Vermont, nice place, in 1966, and his law degree from Boston College of Law in 1969. So, let's see, he's been on Stossel. I kept meaning to go look that up. We should link those because I bet that was a fun show. It was called The Trouble with Lawyers, as well as Morley Safer 60 Minutes, called The Disaster That Wasn't. So we've been waiting on this California Supreme Court ruling, and that's now in. So we're going to kind of talk a little bit about what it was all about and then what happened. You get the whole story today. So, Lawrence, where do you want to start?
Yes.
Where do you want to start?
I think I'd like to start with the two issues that I raised in this case and their history in the state of California, and then get into what the court said, and then we can follow it up by talking about some of the problems and some of the outrageous amounts of money that lawyers are being given from these class action settlements. The two issues that were involved in my case, Lafitte, were, number one, whether the trial courts could use the percentage approach in awarding fees as opposed to using an approach that bases the award on what the lawyers did, how many lawyers worked on the case, what their hourly rates were, what they did. In the 1970s, there was a revolt, I would say, against these percentages because they were wound up awarding lawyers outrageous sums of money in general, and particularly outrageous when you looked at them as a function of how much they were getting an hour for what they did. Although Serrano, I believe, said you had to base the fee on the work the lawyer did, several courts weren't abiding by that. And I had a case out of L.A. County where the judge awarded 33 1/3% of the classes. It was a $19 million settlement.
Wow.
So the lawyers wanted $6 million in fees. That worked out to $1,500 per hour.
Huh.
So I argued to that court, to the Court of Appeals, which rejected my argument as well. But the Supreme Court took the case because, at a minimum, there was a dispute about whether California courts could use percentages. The second issue that I raised, which, by the way, applies across the United States as well, had to do with this problem in class actions where the class is unrepresented. What happens, you know, the court appoints a lawyer to represent the class. Individual class members have no knowledge of the case, have executed no agreement with the lawyer about how much he's going to take. So when the lawyer is suing the defendant and trying to reach a settlement, he's representing the class because all that money that he gets from the defendant is the class recovery. But then what happens at the fee-setting stage, the lawyer's not only no longer representing the class, he's actively against the class because he's trying to get a fee, which means he's trying to reduce the class's recovery. At that point, the class has no representation. The lawyer files declarations. There's no lawyer representing the class. The lawyer introduced experts. There's no experts being introduced to represent the class. So I argued that the court, under due process, because you're taking away the property of these class members, their money, that under due process the court had an obligation to appoint a class guardian so that there was a lawyer on both sides of the issue. Well, an interesting thing happened in this case. The most interesting aspect of this case is that it may mark a sort of, I don't know if the word is revolution, but certainly a turning point in the way we should look at the courts. The law prior and at the time of Serrano, California case, was number one, that when courts set fees for lawyers, it involves the prestige of the courts, the prestige of the bar, and it's linked to the public's confidence in our judicial system. Another legal principle at that time was when the courts allowed a lawyer to represent a whole group of people and he recovered some money for that group, the courts, in calculating fees, had to exercise moderation, and their focus had to be on the rights of those interested in the fund, class members. The third principle was, or is, that the court acts as a fiduciary for the class, meaning the court's first and paramount and only interest is the benefiting the class members. So none of those three legal principles is mentioned in this decision. So the California Supreme Court, from here on out, for this next century, shall we say, has abandoned the notions of the prestige of the courts and the bar being involved in this process, made no mention, rejected the idea that the courts are fiduciaries for the class members, and rejected the idea that moderation should guide their fee awards. They mentioned, although I argued that and wrote that in my brief, their majority opinion mentions nothing about it. On the question of this conflict of interest between the lawyers and the class members, again, the California Supreme Court ignored the issue. They were totally silent. So the way I read this is that those principles that I spoke to you about are sort of principles of a bygone era, and now the courts have openly rejected their role of representing the interests of class members, of instilling confidence in the public about what goes on in courts. And the focus of this court's attention was the lawyers and how do we incentivize lawyers to litigate cases efficiently and how do we make less work for judges.
Wow.
Those were the two principles that guided this most recent Lafitte decision.
Unbelievable. And so,
yes.
So we're going to keep getting 12-cent checks from class actions, I guess, is the long and the short of it, huh?
Well, not only that. Okay, so more important than that, yes, I mean, that's true, but they're not particularly ashamed about that.
No, obviously not. They decided to continue it. I mean, what the heck? Hold on one second, and let's take a really quick break. I think we're going to do is call you right back and see if we can clear up the line a little bit. We have quite a bit of crackliness going on.
Oh, boy.
So we'll see if we can fix the crackliness.
Should I hang up then and you'll call me back?
Oh, sure. Sure, we'll do it all while the commercials are playing and nobody will be the wiser, except maybe we'll have a better connection. How'd that be?
Okay.
So
we're
here chatting about lawsuit abuse. You know, I think everybody's been involved in some kind of class action, even if it was a mindless little postcard you got in the mail that said, hey, you bought a product a year ago and they're suing about it. And if you send it back, you might get something out of it. But I'd kind of like to know from Lawrence, maybe next in the next segment or so, what happens when you really have you're really part of a class action, you were harmed by something. You think about all the really big cases that have gone on with chemical companies and, you know, water pollution type stuff and things like that. And you may wind up getting taken to the cleaners as well. We will be right back. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. That silent part where you were listening to a little extra music was Bill pointing at me, trying to make me talk.
Yeah, I was twisting.
It's not as fun on radio as it is in person.
Spit it out.
You can't make me talk.
I'm making you talk.
Okay, so Lawrence, what about those postcards? I think we talked about that last time, but
we did.
What about these people that are actually really harmed? They all work in a place that had asbestos in the ceiling tiles or whatever, and they're all really sick. Those people are all going to get gypped too. I mean, those of us who get a check for 15 cents and don't even know why, I guess I don't feel so sorry for us, but what about the folks that are in these class action things that are really...
Yeah, is it better to not join a class action in cases where you might do better if you go out on your own, although you might be talking about huge attorney fees, but you might get something out of the deal?
Well, I mean, typically, if the case involves a personal injury, that it is worth having an individual lawyer. But the class actions have become so ubiquitous that now they will basically amalgamate all individual personal injury lawsuits into one, you know, tort, which even if they're for significant sums of money, they get handled in the manner of a class action.
Mm.
But the focus, my focus is not so much on how little money the class members are getting, but in the context of that, how much money the lawyers are getting.
Right.
And in my case, as I say, it was $1,500 an hour, and that's for thousands of hours of work. Another case I'm familiar with, the lawyers got $7,800 an hour, again, for thousands of hours of work. I cited in my brief a legal authority who said that there's anecdotal evidence in the kind of cases you're talking about, mass torts, that lawyers are getting in excess, can get in excess of $10,000 an hour.
Wow.
So these are incredible sums of money that the courts are dishing out. And one of the particularly bad aspects of the recent California Supreme Court decision, that there are some courts that will use a percentage, but they will also use what's called the lodestar. They will ask the lawyers to talk about, you know, what hours they put into the case, what they did, how many lawyers were involved. It's called a cross-check. And it exists in many federal courts. The California Supreme Court went out of its way to say, we're not going to require courts to do a lodestar cross-check. So that means on an hourly basis, the public will never find out how much work was put into these cases, because under the percentage approach, the amount of work is irrelevant, and there's no requirement of a lodestar cross-check. They're leaving that totally to the discretion of the judge, which is leaving it basically to the lawyers for the most part. And where the lawyers didn't work so hard on the case, and therefore the hourly rate is in the thousands of dollars an hour, which, parenthetically, you know, in this recent presidential race, the normal people are fighting for $15 or $20 an hour. These lawyers are getting thousands of dollars an hour, but we'll never know, because the evidence is going to be hidden, because the Supreme Court says it doesn't need to be disclosed.
Wow.
So there's nothing in place in California then for anybody to check or require the lawyers to disclose what their fees are going into the case. They can just arbitrarily assign any amount?
Well, when you say going into the case, I need to explain that class actions, unlike your typical tort situation, the fee is not determined until after the case is settled.
Uh-huh.
Yes, it is true that the one person representing the class may agree to a fee, but that's not particularly relevant to what the judge is going to decide. So the fees are not known going into the case, arguably because the lawyers would like to see which way they can make more money. If it was a particular, if they spent a lot of time or claimed they spent a lot of time and didn't get a lot of money in settlement, then maybe they'd prefer the lodestar amount of work done. But if the amount is very high, the settlement amount's very high, and the time is not that it's not commensurate, so they prefer to have a percentage. And as I say, in California, there's no cross-check. We'll never know.
No,
I mean,
kidding.
This is really a gift by the California Supreme Court to the plaintiff's lawyers, and an abandonment of a role that's been a tradition for over 130 years. It's really quite astounding what the court has done.
And so, in other states, just to kind of give a comparison around the country,
right,
is this unique, or is this kind of following a trend, or setting a trend?
To be candid with you, it is following a trend. Well, there are two parts here. The use of the percentage, the use of, let's say, if I can use the term, a naked percentage, is not particularly a trend. The federal court system, for example, encourages, or I think encourages is the word, a lodestar cross-check. I'm not sure about what, I know some states don't allow percentages. I'm thinking Florida, Massachusetts, and I believe Texas, but many states do. But I need to explain to you why, indeed, that trend does exist. Because as I told you, 30 years ago, the courts were concerned about excessive fees. Now they're not. And how that trend exists is another corruption of the legal system. What these plaintiff class action lawyers did was basically engage in a campaign to have courts get rid of basing the fee on work and just base it on a fixed percentage. And what they've been able to do is hire academicians, law professors mainly, from well-known law schools who over the last 30 years have argued on their behalf and are paid by them to argue that courts should use the percentage approach. They also now have taken to hiring retired judges. This now becomes a plum assignment for a judge who's retired to get hired by one of these plaintiff action law firms to speak in favor of the fee request. In my case, I think there were 12. There were 12 law professors from throughout the country, good law, good rated law schools, who they've been using for 20 and 30 years, and they used them in this case. So this trend is, to me, a phony trend that they've created by abusing the system by using these law professors and these retired judges. I mean, there are a couple of caveats I might add. And these expert witnesses act as criminal lawyers in a sense. Let me explain to you what I mean. I once asked one of these professors, this is not a specific example, but I asked him, how can you say that these lawyers are entitled to $300 million in fees for working in this case? He says, I don't believe that. I said, what do you mean you don't believe that? He said, you just filed a declaration and said they were entitled to $300 million. So he said to me, I'm working as a lawyer here. I'm not saying I believe this. I'm saying I can provide a legal justification for it. So that's the sense I mean that, a criminal lawyer doesn't necessarily believe the client's innocent, but he's allowed to present a defense. So the system has really, it's become corrupted, and now with this new California Supreme Court, they seem to be openly siding with this special interest group of lawyers against the common citizenry, because these fees in the end are paid for by consumers.
Right.
They're paid for in the price of products, what we get, what we don't get. So this is an example of, they call it regulatory capture in other areas where you have these regulatory commissions are supposed to regulate businesses, but they wind up being co-opted and captured and mouthing the interests of the businesses. I will say, I've heard it's true also that after they leave the regulatory commission, then they wind up being hired by the people they were regulating.
There's
an economic motive there. But that seems to be, people I think wouldn't think the court system operated that way. But
it's supposed to be
followed by other states. But this is what's happened now in California, which has the reputation for reform, the reputation for being a trendsetter.
Or not.
or not.
In this particular case, yet again, or not. We have to take a really quick break. We'll be back with Lauren Schombrun. We're talking about the recent California Supreme Court ruling, and for some reason I neglected to actually post that ruling, but I'll do that during the break for you.
Thank you.
You can find it at wethepeopleradio.us, and we'll be right back. And get all the monies in there because California said, California Supreme Court, I should be more specific, said definitely all the money should go to the lawyers.
That's
super
right.
Important on those class
That's
action
right.
cases. Let's just drive that cost up through the roof so those consumers can pay for it.
Yeah.
Bill, you had a
Lawrence, I had a question on,
question.
You know, they said that, or they've changed it now to where they get a percentage of the,
right.
of the, fee, but has that percentage changed much since that ruling, or is this is it pretty much a standard percentage everywhere?
That's a very good question.
Good job,
I would just rephrase it this way.
Oh, except for that,
you know, when an individual hires a lawyer or law firm because they've been in an auto accident, let's say, you've probably heard 33 1/3%.
Right.
The lawyer gets a third. Now, that's one person, one law firm. What they have done, the lawyers and the professors they hire, they've taken that analogy, which is has no bearing to a class action, where you can have thousands and millions of class members and dozens of law firms, and these cases more or less have to settle because they're too big to go to trial. So the answer is that they've taken over these percentages and put them in a totally inapplicable context. And I can tell you this, but this is going back a ways. When the common fund doctrine was first established in the United States, the percentage awarded in that case was, I think, either 5 or 10%. I will say that in California prior to 1977, so that would be, let's say, in the 50s and 40s, the percentages were, They varied. Some of them were 25. I don't know if any of that was 33. They were 15, 20, and 25. So they've definitely ratcheted up to 33 1/3%. But they were in this very inapplicable range before Serrano. And in fact, that's the reason why Serrano came to exist. Because in all these cases throughout the country, the lawyers were using this 25, 33 1/3% or whatever to get these outrageous fees for not with work that wasn't commensurate. So this was a way to change that negative experience.
Yeah, it just seems like there's got to be a more fair way to calculate a fair fee for what they do. I mean, typically in business, as the price of a product goes up, the percentage of profit comes down. You buy a 10-cent stick of gum, it costs, 0.01 cent to produce, but you buy a house and your real estate agent is going to get 6%. Groceries is, 30, 40%. So why don't they take that into consideration?
Well, because number one, the court system has its own logic. Number two, the lawyers have taken control, and I'm talking about plaintiff class action lawyers. They have taken control of the process. They've now taken it. Class members, you remember, have no right to complain. They're not involved in the process. The judges now have ceded their responsibility. So it's a rudderless enterprise with the lawyers running the ship. And that's why it is the way it is. The issue is below the radar of most people. And another problem we haven't spoken about is when you're giving, millions, tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars to lawyers, you're giving them incredible power in our society, be it through money that's given to politicians and judges in campaigns, or just the ability to hire these experts who can say they're from Harvard and Yale and University of Chicago. And they have now, I've used the term now plutocracy. It's more to me a naked show of power by special interests against we the people.
Right.
We're entering, it could be, I don't know, but from my perspective in the law, we're entering this dark period where they say the inmates are running the asylum.
Right.
The judges, the California court system has ceded its supervisory authority to the lawyers seeking fees. And as the lawyers could say, judge, give us a third and you won't have to do much work calculating. And then the judges have said to the lawyers, how much money will it take to incentivize you to handle these cases? That's what now has replaced moderation, prestige, and fiduciary responsibility. They've thrown these concepts out. I don't know if another state is going to read this and be revulsed by it and want to change things, but we know that California typically leads the nation, doesn't follow. But you did make a point, and in this opinion, the California court did say, we join the trend.
Right, right.
Oh, lovely.
Yeah. You brought up another interesting point. If you want to be an attorney, you have to go to law school. You have to pass all your classes and everything, and you have to pass the bar exam. Why then, if they all take the same bar exam and they all have to pass it by a certain score, why then does the Harvard guy get more money than the guy that goes to johnsmith.com law school online? They all pass the same test. Why such a huge discrepancy in fees?
That's a complicated question. Are you asking this in the context of class actions or when just a lawyer goes to work?
Exactly. Yeah, more just the attorney perspective.
Well, I mean, what I can tell you is that when lawyers are hired by private firms, the lawyers who do outstandingly well at the most prestigious law firms, at the most prestigious law schools, get the most money. Now, why that is, I have to assume that these people are smart, and the law firms are looking for smart people.
So it's not the same curriculum at a Harvard law school versus a smaller college. Not the same curriculum, not the same tests and so forth?
Well, in terms of the bar exams, you know, I don't, it's a good question. I don't know if there's ever been a correlation between who passes the bar exam with what scores and what law schools they went to.
Right.
I don't know that there's ever been a correlation in that way. But I mean, I think it's true of, I mean, let's look at radio talk show hosts, what you're doing. Wouldn't you agree that there are people who, you know, in your opinion, not being biased, are very good at what they do, some are sort of okay at what they do, and others do a good job.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, you know, that, and to the extent that correlates to background, education, and experience, that's part of what goes into how lawyers are rated in terms of what they charge. But there's no rule about it. It's kind of whatever you can get.
It's whatever the market will bear. Tell me, it's kind of like what the market will bear. I mean, if people feel that there's more value there, they'll pay for it. But I was curious, with this whole thing, would, if you took a class action, say for instance, and you won, and there were millions of dollars on the line, do you have the ability to say, hey, look, it's inappropriate for me to get, you know, $5 million. I'm going to take my regular fee and the rest goes back to the participants of the class action? Can you do?
Oh, of course, the lawyer. Of course, the lawyers set their own fees.
Okay.
Of course they have the right to do that.
So they could do the right thing if they wanted to.
Pardon?
They could do the right thing if they wanted to.
Of course. But, I mean, arguably we live in an age where you know, richness, getting rich is sort of what's the ideal. And there's no gatekeeper there. As I say, the judiciary has given up its role of being a gatekeeper policing these fees.
Yeah, that is just such a bad idea. We need to take a really quick break and get a word in from Donna Summer, it looks like we're going to have here.
Okay.
Nice, Jared. We'll be right back. You're listening to We the People. We're on with Lawrence Schaumbrum. He'll be right back in the last 15 minutes or so, and we'll talk to you then. Listening to the California court system operate. This is what's going on in the back room. those little coin noises. Okay, they're going to say money in a minute, but it takes a while. Pink Floyd and those darn lead-ins. We get all jacked up. And, Lawrence, you know, just for the record, we're volunteers, so we're complete idiots in the eyes of all the class action lawyers and the judges.
I see.
We still work for free. So what can people, obviously they can't do a lot about this at this point, since you've already tried to fight it and you've gone up through the California Supreme Court, but for those people that are going, hey, wait a second, this is driving up the cost of everything and all that, and would like to do something, got any ideas for them?
Yeah. One thing they can really do is when you, I can't speak to the success of this, but this really is an activist position, is everyone gets those notices in the mail. You mentioned at the beginning of the show that you had gotten one for $13 or 13 cents.
I think it was like 13 cents, actually.
If you read through the notice, it says, if you feel this fee, if you don't agree with the fee the lawyer is asking. Now, of course, if it's in another state, it's another issue, but oftentimes, or when it's near you, you can just show up in court. Actually, you probably have to file a paper saying you're going to be there, but you write a letter. You don't have to file a paper. You write a letter for the judge. You say, I don't agree with this. I want to come into court and complain.
As part of the class action.
I went to the Supreme Court to complain, and they didn't want to hear it at all. No, it's not a simple answer. If it were, we wouldn't be in this position. The lawyers are doing this are very smart. They're very rich. They're very powerful.
They're going to stay that way, obviously. Now
they own the legislature, and they run things. And they're running this one for their benefit.
How long have you been fighting this?
20 years.
What? Just out of curiosity, what started it?
Oh, boy. What started it was I wrote an article for California Lawyer Magazine. I called it Timekeepers Without Watches, Law Firm Billing Practices, and the Corporate Consumer. And I called, I think, 20 or 30 managing partners of law firms. I called 20 or 30 corporate counsel and asked them about billing practices. And I was astounded what these corporate counsel told me about how they were being overbilled by law firms. A lawyer read my article and had a class action. And the class action, as I just mentioned, says if you think the fees are too high, come in and you can object to them. They asked me would I like to do it. I felt uniquely qualified because I had written this article and spoken to so many people about what's going on with billing. And when I went in, I realized that I was the first person in the country to start doing this.
Interesting.
And I was the only person who was fighting for the class members. And it was a cause that I thought was worthwhile, that I thought the court system would rectify in the end, because one has this naive image about, you know, the judges are there to promote justice, and the judges have no particular reason to overpay the lawyers, and the judges care about the general public. So I thought, I had no idea what I was getting into. I've learned more about the court system in America than I would have ever hoped to know being involved in a regular practice. But then I started flying around the country. I've been in from California to New York, from, let's say, Chicago to Texas, appearing in, I don't know how many, you know, 30 different courts, maybe 200 cases.
Wow.
So I began to see this picture developing of what was going on that was taking advantage of the citizens, and I didn't like it, so I wanted to try to do something about it.
Well, good for you. Do you think if you could find a few states that would roll the fees back on these and make them more commensurate with the workload and make them like they should be? If you had a few states that would go that direction, do you think it could domino and force the rest? Or once California and some of the other big ones kind of dig in, it's a pretty much, you know, a done deal?
Well, my guess is that the kind of, just speculating, the kinds of states, you know, what's coming to mind, and this probably isn't even true, it's my naivete, but let's say a state like Oregon or a state like Vermont or Rhode Island, let's say, you know, they seem, I mean, I have no facts here, but they seem like smaller states,
sure,
more connected to the people, you know, not big city politics, that if they would be the ones most likely to do it, make the changes, but there'd be no reason that large, powerful states, basically where lawyers have such force and interest, would go along with it.
Mm. Well, you're
you know, people used to tell me, you know, what's going to change this, and I thought, well, a financial crisis. And then 2009 came along, and it got worse. So now I'm using the term financial catastrophe. I think a financial catastrophe could change this, but I'm not sure anything short of that will.
Well, you said it earlier, that the lobbyists, for tort reform are a very powerful group. Or for non-reform,
I mean,
I should
against
say. Against tort reform is a powerful group, and to get, past them is definitely
impossible.
It's an uphill battle all the way.
Yeah, but I mean, from my perspective, I mean, no one's talking about this, but I can tell people about this as a benefit of what I've been doing, because they say I know where the bodies are buried, I know where the skeletons are, I know what's going on here, so I can explain to people something that is otherwise opaque to most people. So that's what I'm trying to do.
Right, right.
Sure, because most of us, the only connection that the bulk of people have with class action is, seriously, the little postcards or the check for less than a dollar, and it's all a big mystery,
Yes.
Well, how?
And
how
they want to keep it that way.
Exactly. I mean, it's pretty easy to keep us in the dark.
They could, in the sense that we're not going to make you say how much an hour you got for this case. We're not going to make you say what work you did on the case. It's only going to be based on a percentage of the settlement. So the court system wants it to stay a mystery.
Interesting. And the what about the corporations that are having to fork out these gigantic sums of money? You'd think that they'd have a little bit of an interest in, driving this down, or does that just guarantee that they'll get punished if they get hauled into court?
Yeah, there are a couple of answers to that. Legally, once they give the money over to the class, they have no more financial interest.
Mm.
Secondly, and this makes it even worse in a way, what the plaintiff's lawyers will do is ask the defendants to agree to the fee, even though the defendants have no interest in it. The defendants pay the money over to the class. They're not paying the fee. The class is paying the fee. But one has to believe what happens is that they work out a deal where the defendant gets something it wants for agreeing to say that the lawyers can take this money out of the settlement and they won't object. So they've got all the bases covered.
Wow. It's a perfect scenario. It's like those movies where they're walking through the, through the jungle, and then all of a sudden there's a net with some leaves over it.
Yeah.
Well, the defendants have
come,
when I started, this was novel. Now the defendants, they're all part of this large game. I mean, they're happy with the way it's going. They're not. The only problem is when the lawyers get overpaid, it encourages them to sue more companies. But the problem is a typical company gets sued once or twice, they make their bargain with the devil, and it's over.
Right.
Yeah, everybody's
so
looking to just dodge the bullet.
Interest there for the companies did used to get together, but I think now that they've come to grips with this, paying off a class action lawsuit is like paying off a very large electric bill, or who knows what.
Yeah.
In other words, it's a cost of doing business.
Divorcing that first bad wife.
Well, Lawrence, thank you very much for coming on. We've learned a lot.
Thanks a million.
Thank you.
And we linked
I appreciate you allowing me to speak to your listeners.
Absolutely. And we linked the May 8th program for those who want the beginning of the story.
Oh, great. Thank you.
All right. We will chat with you again. You've been listening to We the People Radio. You can find us online, wethepeopleradio.us.